Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
$10 billion of economic aid to the farm industry doesn't exist without this man. You should thank him when you see him.
Referencing Robbie Minnick, Joe Nicosia, cotton merchant.
We're in Washington, D.C. We're walking through and we're telling all the problems of the story about how bad it is in cotton land. And I said to them, you know, it's not just cotton. This situation exists in all in U.S. agriculture. We need to make sure that Congress doesn't hear this as a cotton story, that it's an agricultural story. Robbie took that and ran with it and created and organized a fly-in of not just corn, other row crops, cotton, but also bankers. And they hit, I don't know, Robbie, 125 offices or something like that to where it was. And that was the groundswell that Congress said, we need to do something.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I may seem very exciting, but I actually began my career as a banks analyst and insurance analyst.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent speaking last week in Washington, D.C. at the American Bankers Association's Washington Summit, saying the Treasury Department intends to play a greater role in bank regulation.
And if you think being a banks analyst ruins your eyesight, being an insurance analyst is worse. So I used to read Camel reports, I've read Kansas statutory life insurance reports, and I've seen the way to grow the American dream. Most people that just want to know the way forward. And what we saw with Occupy Wall Street was a disenchantment with the system. And I believe that we have to bring more people into the system. I lived in Miami for a while, and as part of our church, we went and helped the people in the community, underserved communities, prepare their tax returns. We show somebody they're getting a refund that they didn't know they were going to get. It's very, very exciting. So we've got a big, big cohort in the U.S. who just, they want to know, like, how does money work? How does household balance sheet work? And I think the community banks, along with Treasury, can play a big role in that. And it stops financial fraud. I will confess to everyone in this room, my deep, dark secret is I am from South Carolina, and like many people there, I have a Dr. Pepper for breakfast, which puts me at the Circle K on Meeting Street at about between 7 and 6, because I don't do it at home. So it's kind of like getting sent outside. I don't want my kids to see it, so I... But it puts me at the Circle K on Meeting Street in Charleston, South Carolina, 7:30 in the morning. There are bunch of young men in there, primarily African-American. The construction workers go into work, and they'll come up, "Mister, when I win the lottery, will you manage my money for me?" The best thing you can do is not play the lottery. But they don't understand how to put the money away, how to create wealth, how to put it in the stock market. And they want to learn, and I think that that's going to be a big part of the American dream. You know, I think that during the recovery or the rescue phase of COVID, it was very important to get those checks out. We probably sent a little too much out during the recovery phase. But like those households have gone through a lot of that. And I think with proper financial literacy, they could have improved their savings. That College of Charleston, my hometown, has a great program for students who, first ones in their family to go to college or are on full financial aid. You know, these kids show up, American Express is in the freshman quad, signing them up to a credit card, and within 3 semesters, they're over their head in debt and they got to drop out. So, like the American dream, that I think financial literacy or financial security is the American dream. And everyone in this room can do to help. Treasury, if you have ideas, bring them to Treasury. This is Financial Literacy Month, and we're going to be working with a lot of organizations. We're going to do it every April. We're going to have 3 more of these, so I'd love to be a part of that with everybody in this room.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Housing.
Okay.
It is the biggest driver of almost everything in Arizona right now.
Speaking at the recent American Bankers Association's Washington Summit, Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego.
Inflation, fear, people's anxiety in Arizona. You hear it from, parents that are worried that their kids aren't going to be able to buy a home. You're worried, you're hearing from seniors that are worried that they're going to eventually be priced out of whatever house they're in and or rental unit. Some of our highest amounts of growth in homelessness is actually from seniors. Housing is also extremely important for wealth generation, especially for communities of color. Communities of color will use that house and the equity they have in their home to basically finance a lot of big steps in their life, whether it's a small business, is what we see with Latinos in Arizona, but people are also using that to go to college. And so when you have a generation of people in Arizona, and Arizona is 33% Latino, and they're not able to get that first rung into wealth generation, it worries me. So you're creating potentially, decades and decades of, stagnant personal incomes and wealth growth, and it has to really be a full response. And some of that's, on supply side, some of it has to be government regulations, as in cutting down government regulations, but we really have to be looking at it as a real, real problem, because we need to get ahead of that curve now, in order for these communities to take part and take advantage of this going to the future.
Gallego is the lead Democratic co-sponsor in the Senate for the Access to Credit for Rural Economy Act, or ACRE.
Way before politics, I grew up on a ranch in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So I was born in the United States and lived here for a couple of years, and then we went back to take over the family ranch. And, for many of, I don't know if there's some Mexicans here.
I was born in Cuernavaca.
Oh, okay. So okay. Chihuahua, but south of even Chihuahua out in the country. And, Mexican ranches and farms are very small, so not very productive. And what ends up happening a lot of times is these small ranches and farms will eventually go belly up because they can't expand. They don't have the opportunity to borrow money. There's nothing really to borrow money against. And, I saw really what happened, to my communities, to my family when we lost that ranch. And, and that was really the story of hundreds of thousands of Mexicans that ended up starting the first huge migration in the late 1980s into the United States. We could still have something like that happening here, right? We need to make sure that we have banks that are as close as possible to the client and to the customer. And when you're looking at rural America, it's something that I've seen from rural Arizona, it really does help, right? Mm-hmm. Because they understand what's actually happening in those communities. When it comes to housing, if you talk to people, anywhere, and you tell them, like, we have a housing crisis in rural America, they would be absolutely shocked and surprised by that. But it is absolutely true. There are communities in Arizona, rural Arizona, where people are driving hour and a half to work and back, right? That's a tax on your time, tax away from your family, tax away from, recreation, whatever it is, but it's a tax on that. And some of that has to be us. We have a lot of federal land in these rural areas that we should make available for housing. But some of it is also that there is the banking, no offense to the larger banks, they don't see these smaller communities as a good and safe investment, because a lot of times they just don't understand it, let alone with some of the, some of the borrowing and investments that some of the banks have to do on a year-to-year basis for them to be ready for next year's yield. So making sure that there is access to local capital and knowledge, I think, is the most important thing. And that's why I've been a sponsor of it for, I think, now going on 4 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
They say you can throw away your polyester shirt, come back 100 years from now, pick it up and put it on. You throw your jeans away, come back 100 years, you can pick up the zipper. Because one's biodegradable, one of them isn't.
Joe Nicosia is trading operations officer and head of the cotton platform for Louis Dreyfus.
It's not just us. What about Washington? These are the things you're seeing in Washington. They're already attuned to this. People already see it. People are already aware. We just need to now to light that match to get it going. And so if we look at it, one of the other things, though, we have to help ourselves. And nowhere more than here in the High Plains, we need to reform crop insurance. Why? Because it doesn't do us any good if we don't grow the crop. If we don't have any bales, Brazil's just going to take all the business to where things are. So I'm super strong on this issue, that the U.S. needs to change its crop insurance provisions. We need to incentivize harvest over abandonment. The insurance is a safety net. It's not a marketing tool that exists. If you don't harvest your cotton, you are losing your industry. If you don't compete, you will get beat. And we are getting beat. We can no longer take fields like this. There we are in September on the left-hand side. And it just rained a couple weeks or whatever before that. This is that field the very next day. You cannot tell me that's 10 pounds. You cannot. You can't tell me these are 12 pounds, these fields. You can't tell me that that has failed. Now, I don't want any farmer to lose any money. Get all of your proceeds. Get everything that you're due. But let's incentivize the harvest. Because when we need it, every time we don't make a bale or load a bale, somebody else is going to take our sale. We need to do that. We need to do it too because when you look around, it's estimated that a value of cotton is multiplied 20x as it works through the U.S. economy all the way through to the thing. And I know, I don't have to tell you guys, warehousemen. You got warehousemen, you've got the deginners, you got the truckers, you got the traders, you got the bankers, everything. We need the product. So here, leveraging the U.S. consumer. This is one of our ways. The United States is the largest importer of textile products in the world. 16 to 20 million bales of cotton a year we bring into the United States. Only 4 of that is made of U.S. cotton. That means the majority of stuff we do buy are supporting foreign producers. That's pretty stupid, right? So why don't we make a change? So National Cotton Council, American Cotton Shippers, are really getting some traction on this in Washington. We are going to get somewhere along the line legislation and regulation that's going to help us. And we're going to prioritize products made with U.S. cotton. That is going to come, and it rings really well in many, many different situations that are there.
Nick Acia is a merchant and past chairman of the National Cotton Council, speaking recently before Plains cotton growers.
The new crop looks sufficient to me from what I see. Southern crops, price didn't go low enough to hurt that production to where things are. There's that Chinese price I told you I'd tell you about. They get $1.18. Now, it's not on 100% of their production, but it surely is on a high enough percentage so that they're going to continue to grow it. So we need the new farm bill. We need China to get its farm going. And later but last, we need to increase the pie, increase cotton advocacy so we can make cotton great again.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So it's going better than expected. I may live to regret that remark.
That's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent speaking last week at the American Bankers Association's Washington Summit. Said that over the past few years, Wall Street has grown wealthier than before, but the nation is in trouble.
I understand you're seeing Congressman Arrington today. I would urge him for telling that you want certainty on taxes for yourselves, for your customers. And look, the reason I came out from behind my desk, I'm not sure what a budget hawk looks like, but I see one when I look in the mirror. And one of the reasons I came out from behind my desk was this incredible fiscal profligacy and irresponsibility that the last administration did, 6.7% deficit to GDP. We have never seen when we weren't at war or in a recession, and they just spent. So what we're trying to do is bring down government spending, they right-size the federal workforce, and then on the other side, as I just described, through safe, smart, and sound financial deregulation, make it possible for you all to re-leverage the private sector. So we want to deleverage the government sector, re-leverage the private sector, but we can't do it all at once. And I tell these congressmen, I tell the senators, look, our fiscal situation is a 350-pound, two-pack-a-day smoker on the ICU table, and he or she is not going to get off that table and run the Ironman. And we are going to get on a treadmill. We are going to bring the deficit to GDP, hopefully down by a percent every year and get it back toward the long-term target of 3-3.5%. So there's, and look, I understand why some of these congressmen, some of these senators, they are rabid and, like, we got to do it now, but we can't do it all at once, or that will cause a recession. What will keep us from having a recession is making sure that the tax bill doesn't expire, adding back 100% depreciation, and then adding some of President Trump's agenda, no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime, and making, when I bought my first car, I'm 62, when I bought my first car, auto loans were tax deductible. So we're going to do that again for American-made cars.
Also speaking at the American Bankers Association's Washington Summit, Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego.
I'm really a byproduct of the American dream. I just saw the Secretary Reid talking about that. My parents are immigrants, and my mom raised me and my three sisters on her own. Quite a successful story. She sent all four kids to college. I'm not even the successful one in my family.
And you went to Harvard.
I went to Harvard.
Not the successful.
No, my sister went to Harvard. Then she one-upped me and went and became a doctor. And now she's doing an MD, PhD in blood cancer and is at Northwestern University. So, you know, can't win.
There's always one.
And to her credit, after sending all of us to college, then she went back to college, too. And, you know, we moved from a family that was living, five people in a two-bedroom apartment. My first bed was my college dorm room bed. And within 10 years, you know, we moved from poverty to middle class to upper middle class. And, you know, that's a real story of America, of a family that really used the opportunity, the infrastructure opportunity that existed back in the day to move into, you know, what we would call a real American dream.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Every step that I took was always kind of one of those kind of hard-fought tests and races. I was never the favored one, whether it was in the primary or in the general.
Ruben Gallego is a senator from Arizona. Speaking recently at the American Bankers Association's Washington Summit, on Arizona being a nonpartisan state.
For some reason, I always happen to run in the years and Democrats are having the roughest years possible.
Yeah.
So 2010, 2014, and 2024. But I've loved every step of the way. And the best thing about Arizona, it is such a great state. And in a lot of ways, you know, people look at us like we're a red state. Really, it's a truly nonpartisan state in the sense that if you talk to people, you get to know who they are, and they get to know you, they'll give you a good opportunity and a good chance. This is why you see such a mixture of elected officials from Arizona, from all walks of life and from all levels, from Democrats and Republicans. And I think it's it has made, you know, my ability to represent them better. And I think, you know, it's going to be something I'm going to try to keep on leaning on going into the future.
He also stressed the importance of talking to others, even others you don't agree with.
Democrats are afraid to talk to people that they don't know where their opinions are. And they're sometimes afraid to go into areas that aren't necessarily, quote-unquote, safe spaces. And it just keeps evolving to the point where we end up just going and talking to the same people over and over again, and then we kind of get into this bubble, and that ends up giving us some really bad information, and that ends up being bad policy and bad politics. You know, one of the things that we did on my campaign is we went everywhere. We talked to everyone, and we weren't afraid to go into, you know, rural red Arizona. And there's a reason why we were able to succeed in rural Arizona. We lost rural Arizona, by the way, not that I won it, but we, you know, did significantly better than the top of the ticket in rural Arizona because we were talking to, Americans, Arizonans, not Republicans. We went, we met with them and you know, had conversations. We also are afraid of our own our own tent. And I was just having a discussion with some people about this. We pride ourselves in saying we're this big tent party, which is true, but we're afraid of everyone's opinions within that big tent. And we want everyone to be aligned in same thought within that big tent. And if not, we want you to walk out of that tent, but at the same time, still vote for us. Mm-hmm. Right? It just doesn't make sense. Like, we have to be able to be uncomfortable in our coalition. And to give credit to the Republicans, they have a very something coalition, but they are very good about being in the same tent and being uncomfortable with it, because guess what? They have the shared goal of power and pushing through legislation. For us, we want everyone to vote for us, but only if we have 100% agreement, and only if you're willing to go even once we get into power with 100% agreement in everything we do. And I think that's just, it's not logical. It's not a way you put a coalition together to win, and it's also not a way you put a coalition together to govern. And so being afraid also means you should not be afraid to talk to your own, you know, people within your own tent saying, you know what, I'm going to have to say no to that. I don't believe in defunding the police. Right, I don't believe in defunding ICE. That is not where, you know, my voters are. That's not where the majority of supermajority of America is. But I'm going to be in this tent, and you should understand where people like me are coming from.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You've said you've been negotiating deals. Foreign countries have already retaliated against our farmers and ranchers and small businesses.
U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer testifying last week before the Senate Finance Committee and taking questions from Oregon's Ron Wyden.
How can you commit that negotiations are not just going to stop bleeding, but are actually going to open up markets that the Trump tariffs have closed off?
So, Senator, we've already had many countries, many of our markets, explain that they are not going to retaliate against the United States. And, in fact, Vietnam, for example, they've lowered their tariffs already on cherries. They've lowered them on almonds and apples, things I know are important to the Pacific Northwest. And this is exactly the right direction that we want to go in. I look forward to hearing from you what other kind of market access you want as we enter into these negotiations.
What's the status of China? As you know, that's a big market for us in the Pacific Northwest. What's the status of discussions there? I don't see much progress. What I see is it looks like it's going to escalate and escalate some more and hurt our consumers and our small businesses in our part of the world.
Well, Senator, unfortunately, China for many years seems to be choosing its own path on market access. Again, they have agency in this. They elected to announce retaliation. Other countries did not. Other countries signaled that they'd like to find a path forward on reciprocity. China has not said that. And we will see where that goes. I think we need to work with our closest friends to make sure that we have trading arrangements that work. And if the Chinese are open, you know, we'll see what. You know, but they haven't signaled that at all. So I don't think that's in the very near term with China.
I just am concerned that there's no strategy at all. I'm committed. We understand in the Pacific Northwest what the stakes are. To have a smart, tough strategy, I don't see any strategy at all. And you really haven't said much about what the strategy is this morning.
Senator, I appreciate your concern. I want to keep having a conversation with you about this, but I see a distinct difference between those countries who have come to us and they said, we understand your issues, we understand the deficit, we understand your desire for reciprocity, and we want to work with you on this. And the Chinese approach, which has been, we're going to retaliate. We're trying to remedy a situation. We're trying to remedy a situation that's persisted for many years. And it would be wonderful if the Chinese agreed with that and wanted to persist in, you know, work with us on that. But that's not where they are. And the president has recognized this,
let's focus on other partners. Let's talk before my time is up about services. The United States is a services powerhouse, from travel and technology to finance and media. Our services industry account for nearly 80% of the U.S. GDP and 8 out of 10 American jobs. Other countries are responding to Trump's global tariffs by retaliating against American services. Can you explain how your tariff actions aren't putting our services exports at risk like so much of your trade policy?
Senator and Chairman Crapo mentioned this. We had India already pull down a digital advertising tax that affected some of our most competitive tech companies. We're already in conversations with other countries that if they want to have reciprocal trade with us, that's something that we need to consider as well. And we expect them not to discriminate against our services companies. We have some of the most competitive in the world. I agree with you. And to me, that's part of this calculation.
I wrapped up with the services question because it seems to me it's classic Donald Trump. Really good at talking about problems, even saying that there is some reason to go forward, identifying a problem, but pretty damn bad at fixing them. And there's going to be a whole lot of collateral damage in the process if you all continue with these trade policies and services and in other areas.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
As expected, minimal changes recorded in USDA's April crop production report and world agricultural supply and demand estimates. Most of the data designed to move the domestic balance sheet derives from last month's quarterly grain and rice stocks estimates. The ledgers for corn, soybeans, and rice record month-over-month decreases in ending stocks, while wheat ending stocks increased in April. The supply and demand estimate adjustments did little to impact price, as none of the major quarterly stock commodities reported a change in the season-ending average price from the previous month. The U.S. cotton balance sheet, however, noted a slight decrease in exports for March and a one-dime increase in the season-ending average price. The loan production report was for our nation's orange crop, a 2% increase from the previous month, yet an 8% decline from year-over-year final utilizations. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.